Arabia in exchange for military contracts.
I mean, I can certainly assure you, I mean, that we, and I believe most companies, are not in the business of making payments, passing, as you suggest, large sums of money to employees of governments. I mean, it is just not the way, I mean, business is done.
Serious Fraud Office, or SFO, as part of the UK Attorney General's office, started an extensive investigation. This department followed the links of this case in Britain as well as in the US. The continuation of this investigation caused concern to Saudi officials because they were looking for the third phase of a Yamama deal. It was time for Bandar to return home because the investigations into his financial records as well as the follow-up of the press were causing problems for him. On September the 8th, 2005, he returned to Saudi Arabia. At the same time, Saudi Arabia threatened Tony Blair, the new British Prime Minister, that it will suspend its security cooperation with London on terrorism if they did not stop their investigation. Blair seriously warned all the members involved in the investigation, including the British ambassador to Saudi Arabia and the British Attorney General. Blair urged everyone at all levels to stop the investigation because it could threaten the British citizens' lives.
I don't believe the investigation incidentally would have led anywhere except to the complete wreckage of a vital strategic relationship for our country in terms of fighting terrorism, in terms of the Middle East, in terms of British interests there.
But threats became reality.
Breaking news we're getting from the PA Newswire that there's been reports of an explosion outside Liverpool Street Station.
July 7th, 2005, London bombings that killed 52 people and injured 700 others was a clear signal to the British government that it was time to end the investigation, and they stopped it shortly. The strange thing was that a few months later, Prince Bandar bin Sultan was the head of the Saudi National Security Council, and he was in charge of terrorist groups' files, including Al-Qaeda. In 2007, when the media controversy over corruption in a Yamama deal subsided, the Saudi king traveled to London and Bandar accompanied his father in the Saudi delegation. They had several meetings and Saudi Arabia signed a $20 billion contract with the BAE. Most countries were trying to take advantage of this lucrative market, but the United States was trying to get the most out of it.
Over the past 30 years, the United States has sold over $50 billion worth of military weapons and services to the Saudis, more than we've sold to any nation on earth.
And we have had, for more than 40 years now, a relationship and an agreement, mutual security agreement with the Saudi Arabians, and it has been beneficial to both of us.
Saudi Arabia has had the largest arms purchases from the U.S. among Arab countries since the 1950s. But the U.S. has been trying to play a bigger role in this market. This time, Washington was not worried anymore about shifting the balance of power between Saudi Arabia and Israel. As Barack Obama took office, many around the world hoped that U.S.'s approach to war and arms sales would change.
Paul Opel, the Nobel Peace Prize laureate for 2009, President Barack Obama, to come forward and receive the gold medal and the diploma.
He was the fourth U.S. president to receive the Nobel Peace Prize in his first year in office.
So yes, the instruments of war do have a role to play in preserving the peace. And yet this truth must coexist with another, that no matter how justified, war promises human tragedy. The soldier's courage and sacrifice is full of glory, expressing devotion to country, to cause, to comrades in arms. But war itself is never glorious, and we must never trumpet it as such.
But the story was different. The interests of military industry were so great that all U.S. governments, both Democrat and Republican, sought to gain a greater share of this market. The Obama administration broke the record by signing the highest arms deal with Saudi Arabia in the history of relations between the two countries. According to Pentagon figures, the Obama administration exported $278 billion in arms sales to the world during his 8 years in office, and delivery of orders to Saudi Arabia alone amounted to $115 billion. After the Arab Spring protests in 2011 calling for change, Saudi Arabia worked hard to maintain its trusted friends in those countries, including Yemen and its former president Ali Abdullah Saleh, who was a Saudi royal family's old friend. Saudi Arabia could help Saleh, but they found another alternative. While the Yemeni government was trying to designate Abdurrabu Mansour Hadi as the president, economic and security problems were increasing day by day. Yemen's popular Houthi Ansarullah movement was trying to control the situation in Yemen by cooperating with individuals and parties such as Ali Abdullah Saleh, and the situation was getting better to some extent. This news was not in favor of Saudi Arabia, a country that had been influential in Yemen for years, so it started a bloody war against Yemen, a nation that is one of the most deprived Arab and Islamic countries. Yemen became the target of the most severe ground, aerial, and maritime strikes after a complete siege on this country. Saudi Arabia launched its offensive on March the 25th, 2015, forming a coalition of Arab governments and Western countries. The United States and Britain provided intelligence and weapons for Saudi Arabia on its war on Yemen. According to Saudi media, the offensive was supposed to end in a few days or at most a few weeks and the new government would fall, but the war continued for months and years. Saudi Arabia entered a battle in which it only had to be the winner and the other side had to surrender and lose.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. Not surprisingly, stress levels shot up during the pandemic, with reported anxiety scores nearly doubling because of COVID-19 and stay-at-home orders. In addition, 20% reported that their anxiety was severe enough to affect their daily routines. Researchers noted that the magnitude of increase in anxiety was significantly greater in people with obesity. According to a study, the COVID-19 pandemic has led to significant health effects well beyond the virus itself. The study authors stated that the fear of contracting the coronavirus has significantly impacted lifestyle behaviors alongside declines in mental health. The study also highlighted how certain unhealthy and healthy behaviors can go together. People who reported a shift towards unhealthy eating habits were also likely to report being more sedentary, less physically active, and having trouble falling asleep. By comparison, people with healthy eating habits reported an increase in their physical activity levels. We now present you an article written by Rachel Grumman-Bender. The piece is titled, Study Says Weight Gain Anxiety Levels Have Increased During the Coronavirus Pandemic. Please stay with us to hear more of Rachel Grumman-Bender's article. A new study shows that, not surprisingly, some people's healthy habits have fallen by the wayside during the coronavirus pandemic, leading to weight gain, whilst anxiety levels have nearly doubled. According to Yahoo Life, for the study, which was published in the journal Obesity, online surveys were distributed in April of 2020 to more than 7,700 normal weight, overweight, and obese adults across the globe, to glean information about how the pandemic affected their dietary habits, their physical activities, and mental health. The researchers found that healthy eating actually increased during the pandemic due to less eating out and increased cooking. But people also reported snacking more, as well as consuming more sweets and sugar-sweetened drinks. They also started moving their bodies less often during the pandemic. The amount of time people spent being physically active, as well as the intensity of their workouts, went down, while sedentary behaviors went up. More than 27% of the study's total participants reportedly gained weight during the pandemic. On the flip side, more than 17% of people reported losing weight. It's worth noting that participants who reported gaining weight made few changes to their eating habits, but had the largest declines in physical activity. By comparison, those who lost weight not only improved their healthy eating habits, but they were also more physically active and avoided slipping into more sedentary behaviors. Not surprisingly, stress levels shot up during the pandemic, with reported anxiety scores nearly doubling because of COVID-19 and stay-at-home orders. In addition, 20% reported that their anxiety was severe enough to affect their daily routines. The study authors also noted that the magnitude of increase in anxiety was significantly greater in people with obesity. According to the new study, the COVID-19 pandemic has led to significant health effects well beyond the virus itself. The study authors stated that the fear of contracting the virus has significantly impacted lifestyle behaviors alongside declines in mental health. The study also highlighted how certain unhealthy and healthy behaviors can go together. People who reported a shift towards unhealthy eating habits were also likely to report being more sedentary, less physically active, and having trouble falling asleep. By comparison, people with healthy eating habits reported an increase in their physical activity levels every day. Jennifer Carter, a sports psychologist in the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Health at the Ohio State University Wexner Medical Center, said, "The study finds mirror what I've heard from many psychotherapy clients. Somewhat better nutrition and somewhat worse exercise during the coronavirus pandemic." She did not participate in the new research. One of the study's authors, Emily Flanagan, a postdoctoral fellow at the Pennington Biomedical Research Center, said that one of the reasons physical activity went down for some is that many of the gymnasiums, health clubs, and other facilities where people usually exercise were closed, and exercise equipment was in short supply. Emily Flanagan added, "There were also drastic changes to people's work schedules, their children's school or daycare, which added hours to many parents' days. Factors in the increase in anxiety and getting less sleep, and it's not hard to see why people were less motivated to stick to their exercise routines. If you're tired and grouchy when you get up in the morning, you're probably not going to exercise as much. If you're sleep deprived, you're not going to make wise food choices." Dr. Asim Shah, professor of executive vice chair of psychiatry and behavioral science at Baylor College of Medicine, who was not associated with the new study, agrees, saying, "People staying at home, and especially for parents who now find themselves managing their kids' schooling as well as their responsibilities, have increased." Dr. Asim Shah added, "It's stressful. You can't find spare time to do a lot of things. The schedule has become too congested and too busy. All of this creates anxiety, which," Carter explains, "is challenging for most people to deal with." Carter said, "Sometimes we use ineffective coping strategies that initially bring temporary relief, but in the long term bring more distress." Adding, "Unbalanced nutrition and unbalanced exercise are two of these ineffective strategies." As far as why people who are obese are having a particularly hard time with anxiety during the coronavirus pandemic, Carter believes that that may be due to fear of the virus. She said, "People who are obese constantly hear about obesity as a risk factor for negative outcomes with COVID-19. She added, "People with obesity are likely very frightened. Unfortunately, we sometimes try to cope with such fear by eating comfort foods. Or we may be bombarded by fear and anxiety that we don't feel the mental energy to get up and exercise, especially when gymnasiums, swimming pools, and other facilities are closed." Emily Flanagan, a postdoctoral fellow at the Pennington Biomedical Research Center, agrees that fear is likely to be a factor, saying that the fact that people with obesity are at a much higher risk of severe illness and hospitalization undoubtedly contributed to the higher anxiety levels. Carter also points out that the lack of social support due to physical distancing is taking a toll on people's mental health. She said, "We're social beings, wired to seek connection, and isolation can feel devastating." Dr. Asim Shah backs this up, saying that people are getting lonely. He noted there's less physical contact during the coronavirus pandemic, such as hugs from close friends and family members, which affects both mental and physical health. Dr. Shah said touching releases the hormone called oxytocin, which helps relieve stress and improves immunity. He said that these pandemic-related mental health effects will be long-lasting. he added. This is an ongoing disaster that's lasted nearly a year. You can imagine that the mental health impact will be felt for over a decade. With winter ahead, with spells colder weather and less daylight hours that make it more challenging to spend time outdoors, as well as looming lockdowns in some areas across the United States, some experts are concerned that this will only serve to further worsen people's mental and physical health. Emily Flanagan says, "We're worried about this. The holidays are going to be hard. We know that extended periods of isolation aren't good for people's mental health. We're recommending that physicians increase the number of mental health screenings during and after the pandemic." Emily Flanagan also recommends that doctors remain connected to their patients through virtual visits, which can help assuage patients' concerns about the safety of in-person visits. Both of these steps can help prevent irreversible health effects from the pandemic. To help people maintain healthy habits while stuck indoors, either because of cold weather or stay-at-home orders, Emily Flanagan notes that, as many people have discovered during the pandemic, there are any number of online videos that show you how to exercise without equipment and learn to cook healthy meals. For mental health, Emily Flanagan points out that the use of telehealth consultations has drastically increased throughout the coronavirus pandemic, allowing people to conveniently access help at home. Telehealth sessions with your healthcare provider are also a strategy to treat and manage mental health with less time commitment, that is, no travel, and limit virus exposure. Dr. Shah recommends spending time with close friends and family members outdoors whilst physically distancing and wearing face masks. But if you're not able to safely see loved ones in person, he says the video calls are better than nothing, adding, "People need to socialize." While Carter acknowledges there are challenges ahead, she says that there is also hope related to vaccines, better treatment, and the start of a new year. She adds, "We are paying too much attention to what could go wrong without also asking what could go right."
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing 69 Minutes of 86 Days, directed by award-winning Norwegian filmmaker Egil Hoshel Larsen. And joining me in the studio, we have Maria Duarte, who is a film critic for the Morningstar newspaper, and who has also worked as a news journalist in both television and radio for many years. And beside her is Zita Holborn, who is the co-founder and national chair of Barack UK, and has been coordinating solidarity, aid, and fact-finding missions in support of refugees in France for over 2 years. Now, 69 Minutes of 86 Days is a documentary about the hardships of being a refugee as seen through a child's eyes. With minimal dialogue, the director takes us into the journey of 3-year-old Syrian child Leanne and shows her family trekking through Europe with the goal of reuniting with her grandfather to settle in Sweden. First of all, welcome both of you to the show. Thanks very much for coming on. Now, I have to say, I thought this was a magnificent documentary, extremely moving, and it's the kind of documentary that stays with you for days, especially because it was told from a child's perspective. Now, Maria, if I could start with you as our guest film critic, what was your impression of this documentary?
Well, it does stay with you, and I found that it was one of the most unique documentaries on the refugee crisis that I've seen.
and actually quite an impressive directorial debut by Larson himself. He was a cameraman, he was a cinematographer, and you can tell that in the way that it's shot. And what's interesting is that he shot it from her perspective and her height. So the camera moves with her. And it's very intriguing and inspiring use of putting this story across, and it's quite a humanising way of looking at it. Mm-hmm. And the little girl is well, adorable. And the fact is that there are no voiceovers, there's no narration, you have no idea what's going on, very much like the little girl herself, Leanne. She has no idea. You know, at three, you go where you're taken. And for her, in many ways, it was kind of like a game, although at times the camera kind of stays on her and she looks really, really serious.
I wanted to ask you actually a bit more about that point, yeah. About the style of the filmmaking, because the Larson does use low-angle steadicam shots with mixed with long takes, as you were saying. And do you think that the director, Larson, was successful in trying to transfer the child's experience to the viewer in this way?
Well, I think so, because you can see her energy and her hope and her childlike wonderment. When the film opens, it's a tracking shot of the beach, and you see all these things strewn on it. You have no idea what's coming or where it's going, and then it kind of tracks up. You see all these refugees queuing up. They're being given flip-flops, being given food, and then it hones in on her and her look and what's going through her little mind. We have no idea. You know, it's a child's world. But to her, you know, it's all games as well. But she knows that she's being taken from her home to Sweden, and that's how we learn about it, because at no point are you told where they are, where they're going, really, apart from a song that she sings where she says, oh, we're going to Sweden in Germany to live with Grandpa, you know.
That was a really endearing moment.
Yeah,
it was there to help keep her going through that journey. And Zita, I want to bring you in here. What was your impression of the film? Do you agree with Maria's take?
I agree with quite a bit of what Maria has said. I think it was quite endearing to show it through the eyes of a child in the way it was shot. It was a unique perspective that we don't normally see or hear. Usually the times we hear about children are in a very technical way, as you know, unaccompanied minors or when they've tragically died. So it was positive to see it from the perspective of a child, but I also think that in some places, you know, the narrative was missing. But you have to look at what the purpose of the film was, and was it to do what lots of other people have done before, or was it to do something different and to show this perspective on it?
No, I agree with you, actually, and I want to explore those details a bit later on in terms of how powerful that impact had by having minimal dialogue. She's such a cute, gorgeous little girl, Leanne, and as a viewer, I feel like you feel the need to protect her in that hostile world that she's in. And Maria, you were touching upon this a bit earlier on. What are some of the hardships that we witness Leanne and her family encounter on their journey?
Well, there's an interesting shot of them all being sort of held against a barrier and the police kind of treating these refugees as cattle, really. And you kind of think, that this isn't on, you know, this isn't right. But I don't think that's what the film wants to show you. I think it wants to show you the fact that they don't know what's happening. She doesn't know what's happening. It's crazy. It's frightening in many ways. And it's disorientating. So hence why there's no narration. You have no idea where they are at any given time, what country they're in.
Do you think this is a metaphor in general, sorry, as the viewers, that we sympathise with Leanne because it's a metaphor for the Western audience's general ignorance of the issue, perhaps, that we don't know where they are, what's happening?
Well, exactly, yes, in some ways. And also that she's an ordinary little girl. She's got a backpack from the film Frozen. You know, this could be any of us at any given time. And basically to... you know, comes to terms, sort of empathise with her situation. The thing is, we've seen films where you see children being, you know, treated horrifically, and so this is a different way of getting the message across, and poignantly, and with this three-year-old girl, and she is very, I mean, she's gorgeous to look at, and very sweet, and very cute, and very funny. There's a scene where she's playing with her sister, and she's, you know, giving her a lollipop, and the whole thing is that the family are trying to keep it as normal as possible, but it isn't a normal situation.
And Zita, from your experience working with refugees and refugee children, What kind of conditions are they enduring and kind of problems that they have on journey?
Well, they're going through horrific conditions and experiences. What we didn't see in the film for Leanne is some of the experiences that refugee children that I've met and worked with, where you know, they're having to cross deserts, where they're having to go on very small boats in perilous conditions across the Mediterranean Sea. And effectively, you know, the families are risking their lives to get them to a safe place. They're staying in very harsh conditions, where at the moment, if you look at what's happening in Calais, with both of the camps destroyed, people don't have tents. They're staying outside. The police have been stealing their blankets and their sleeping bags, if they get them, and stripping those away from them. They were over the last few months, they've had a one-hour slot in which they can access a tank of water to have a wash in front of hundreds of people. So actually, the conditions are stark. When there wasn't an infrastructure in Dunkirk, and particularly in Calais, there was a school and an art school, and so there was some system in place for children to have, you know, snippets of normality.
So would you say that Leanne workshops. Is one of the lucky ones that got away?
If you look at her journey in the film, the bits that we see of it, seems to be quite a positive journey compared to some of the refugee children I've met. I'm not saying it's completely positive, because obviously a long journey like that, there are risks all the way. It's tiring. You're staying in tents and camps and so on, so it's not easy. But I also think I don't quite agree with you in terms of Leanne's naivety. I think actually she's very intelligent and very articulate. And if you listen to the little things she says and the little songs she sings, you can see actually she is reflecting on her conditions, particularly on the coach when she talks about what happened to the cat.
Mm-hmm. Yeah? Yes, I thought that was more really engaging. I wish I saw more of those scenes. So as we were saying, we do enjoy watching these tender, sweet moments with Leanne and these precious moments. I think they give us a sense of relief from the harsh reality of a refugee's life. Maria, the director, Larsen, said at the Copenhagen Film Festival earlier this year that in this film he didn't want to focus so much on the political aspect of the refugee crisis. He wanted to focus more on a child's perspective and sort of gives some hope, I suppose, to their situation. Do you think that the film should have been more political, though?
It's an interesting question. The thing is, if it had been more political, then it would have been like every other documentary that we've seen on the refugee crisis. He was trying to get his point of view across by Leanne, and he succeeded that to some certain extent. The thing is that it is a snapshot of what they went through. We don't know what the rest of it was like. You know, anyone who has a three-year-old, to keep them entertained for 86 days, I'm sorry, but it would be a nightmare, you know. The thing is, we need to be hopeful, but we need to change people's attitudes, and people are now kind of entrenched about the Syrian refugee crisis, sadly, and this is a different way of putting it across, to engage people in that discussion and to look at it. It is, you know, we're like voyeurs in this film, and what we see is what he's allowing us to see. So the rest may have not been as touching or, you know, as moving or as sweet as the scenes that we saw. Mm-hmm. It'd be interesting to see, you know, as I said, keeping a three-year-old entertained or protected from what's going on is really difficult. Their attention span is very short.
Mm-hmm. And I think Larsen used the child, though, on purpose in the sense that she's untainted by the world, and she's an innocent, pure soul. So she doesn't know the differences with the cultural and political conflicts.
No.
So in a sense, it gives you a sort of humanistic approach, I think,
indeed,
to the refugee crisis.
And you need to put a face on it. That's the thing. You've got to humanise people. You know, you can't just say, you know, bunch of Syrian refugees as a whole. These are people. These are people just like you and like us, going through terrible ordeal. You know, to have to move from, you know, your country to somewhere completely foreign. My parents did it, you know, in the 60s. And my mother kind of never got over it, really, because it was a completely different culture coming to Britain. Circumstances, you can't, they're not comparable. But what I'm saying is, if you have to leave your home, and in their case, they're forced to leave their home to go somewhere else, and people are not giving them the respect that they kind of deserve, or the kindness. Do you see what I mean?
No, I see what you mean. It's a really good point.
It's you know, we're supposed to, you know, care for everyone. We're supposed to care for each other, and we've become, you know, in the world now where it's every man and woman for themselves.
Mm-hmm. And Zita, I just wanted to read a statistic here about refugees. So according to the UN Refugee Agency, 86% of the world's refugees are hosted by developing countries. So the countries hosting the most refugees are Turkey, home to some 2.5 million, Pakistan, 1.6 million, Lebanon, 1.1 million, and Iran, around 1 million. Now, what do you think of the Western world's efforts in sheltering and accommodating the refugees? Do you think they could be doing a better job?
They could definitely be doing far more than they're doing. Actually, the UK record is woeful. You know, for 2 years I've been working with people who are refugees in France who are stuck in limbo, effectively, trying to get to the UK. Many of them are children. The average age currently of the people that are there, if you want to call them adults, is around age 17 or 18. So this is very young people that have left home when they were children, have struggled and travelled alone, may have lost all their family members, have had to form bonds and family to travel across Europe to try and get to a safe place, and are being separated from their families and connections here in the UK. And then all the scapegoating and demonising of migrants, and trying to blame the cuts and austerity impact that we're experiencing here on migrants is an absolute disgrace. We've had the Immigration Act introduced in the UK, which is like seeks to create an apartheid-like state. And then even when people are here, we're seeing mass deportations to countries like Jamaica, Nigeria, and Pakistan. So yes, the UK and other European Western countries could do far more. They are not demonstrating humanity. And actually, I think that's what we saw in the film. We saw the human story. We saw humanity. We saw the reality of a family trying to shield and protect their children. And you could see the sadness, pain, and fear in the eyes of the adults, but they tried to protect the children from that and, you know, keep things positive so that the children, and particularly Leanne, could have hope for a better future.
Thank you for that point. It was a really good point. I want to touch more on what you were saying about the anti-refugee sentiment across Europe. Now, we're in the final part of the discussion of this programme now, and I just want to talk a little bit about how, in the documentary, there isn't no specific reference to the country of origin of the refugees. Do you think Larson did this in an attempt to perhaps internationalise the refugee issue?
Maybe, but also to keep you disorientated in a way, like they were. We assume that they started off from a Greek port, and then they go through, I think they went through Hungary and Austria and then Germany and then on to Sweden. But you have no idea where they're going or what the passage of time, actually. You know, and only by the signposts and people speaking in German do you realise they're in Germany. So that's basically to keep it, you know, to keep you on your toes and to give you the experience or part of the experience that they went through, because Leanne had no idea where she was going.
And Zita, would you agree with Marie's take?
Not necessarily. I can't speculate on why it was done like that and why it wasn't mentioned. You know, within a few minutes, I'd figured out that's where they were from anyway, because I can hear them speaking and, you know, I can look at them and guess where they're from. But actually, I think the important part of the film wasn't about, he wasn't trying to tell their backstory and what they were fleeing from. There was no focus on that. It was about the journey you go on as a refugee. So all people who are refugees are going through those same trials and tribulations and challenges, and, you know, it's tiring, it's long, it's challenging. So I think that the focus was on, this is what you're going through. Here is a family who are a tight family, who are supporting each other, looking after each other. They're a loving family. you know, they're embracing their children, they're sticking together, and this is what you have to do to get through a perilous and long and difficult journey, which is not just physically difficult, but actually mentally and spiritually.
And psychologically, yeah. Definitely. But I just wanted to ask you, a lot of people would argue that, in fact, refugees getting to their destination in Europe is actually not the hardest part, given the rise of the increase in anti-refugee, anti-immigrant sentiment in Europe, with far-right groups, for example. Do you think it's likely that children such as Leanne will face a lot of racism and abuse once they settle in the country?
Absolutely. Actually, I sat, you know, as the credits came up at the end of the film, thinking, okay, this is all very fairy tale, happily ever after. This is not the reality of what people go through as refugees, or even migrating, you know, where my family came and migrated to the UK. She will face discrimination. And often young people that I meet who are refugees in France, they ask, what's it like in the UK? It's better there, and it's going to be better for us, and it's going to be better with quality. And I'm truthful to them. I tell them what I do as an activist, that actually my entire life has been dedicated to campaigning against racism and prejudice and xenophobia, because we're still facing those challenges. So it won't be easy for her. It's going to be challenging.
So Marie, would you like to see a follow-up documentary to see how Leanne's life would play out?
It would be interesting, but again, if he's going to go for this style of documentary, then, you know, it's cinematic, basically. But I suspect as a three-year-old, I mean, I was 10 months old when I came to Britain, you get used to your surroundings and, you know, you become part of society and you forget what...
You integrate.
And she's three and she will presumably integrate. But, yeah, it's...
Perhaps many challenges lie ahead. And
indeed. And it's scary times at the moment, and also post-Brexit, I have to say. So
it's scary times indeed. And I'm afraid we'll have to end it there, but thank you very much. I enjoyed this discussion of the documentary. And that's it for this episode of Doc Review. Thanks to my guests and to you. I've been Camelia Shambayati, and see you on the next episode of Doc Review.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید. ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می‌کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد میشید به حق تعالی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, if you remember, we have been discussing Imam Khomeini's teaching method for a couple of weeks. One of the most important features of Imam Khomeini's teaching method was that he observed the respect of ulema in various fields of Islamic sciences. Although he had a very critical spirit, as we had discussed earlier, he never allowed his students to disrespect other ulema and great figures, no matter if they were alive or dead. Today, we will touch upon this aspect of his personality. Stay tuned, please. Ayatollah Muhammad Emomi Kashani says, Imam Khomeini used to keep high esteem for ulama and jurisprudence and remember them very respectfully. When he wanted to reject their remarks on jurisprudence, principles of jurisprudence and philosophy, he would do it with respect. For example, he would not say, that a scholar has not realized this or has not paid attention to this. Late Hojjatul Islam Mustafa Zamani also said, whenever the Imam wanted to quote a subject from a scholar, he would remember him with respect, and if he didn't accept the subject, he would mention it with a special respect, and then would reject it with scientific argumentation. Yet, he would sometimes use the phrase, Rizwanullah ta'ala alayh, meaning, may God be satisfied with him, for the scholar. He would reject the special respect for the writer, even the books that he thought were not usable for higher levels of jurisprudence. Another aspect of Imam Khomeini's teaching method was that he taught very attractively, smoothly, and expressively. Late Ayatollah Muhammad Fazil Lankarani narrated an interesting memory on this, saying, Imam Khomeini's way of expression in teaching was so sweet and expressive that nobody needed to ask another one to explain the Imam's view. He would directly present all subjects with his sweet and clear expression. Imam Khomeini would use special phrases and appropriate examples on abstract issues to elucidate them for students. Ayatollah Jafar Sobhani, one of the present sources of emulation, says in this regard, the Imam's general teaching method or his speech was in a way that he would refrain from complicated speaking and try to deliver intellectual and theoretical issues, which are often far-fetched for understanding with the clearest phrases and evident examples. He would even explicate rational and intellectual issues which are beyond senses and materials in the form of examples. Thus, his teaching and remarks had a special attraction in the seminary, and few could say that he had not benefited from the Imam's course, provided that he had the talent to learn that course. Hojjatul Islam Sayyid Kamal Faqih Imani also says, Imam Khomeini was very powerful in making the students understand courses. This caused the students and ulema to attend his classes, and the Salmasi Mosque would be crowded so much so that sometimes it would extend to the alley. Dear listeners, another aspect of Imam Khomeini's classes was that he was not rigid and used to tell jokes for refreshment of students. Late Hojjatul Islam Ali Davani narrated this interesting memory. Although Imam Khomeini was very tacit, he would say a joke at the class so that the audience would laugh loudly. While he was indifferent and silent as if he had not said anything. For instance, one of his students from Azerbaijan area insisted on his opinion and the Imam wanted to silence him. At last, Imam Khomeini told him, Yokh, meaning no in Turkish. In this way, both that student and the audience laughed and he was silent. Imam Khomeini sometimes would even joke with his elder son, Haja Mustafa, to refresh the class, although he deemed high respect for his scientific status. Hojjatul Islam Sayyid Abdul Majid Iravani says, one day in Holy Najaf, late Haja Mustafa, who was a great mujtahid and a scholar, raised a question on a hadith. The Imam answered him but his son was not convinced and asked for more explanation. The imam said jokingly, "Don't say such things, lest people laugh saying that you are illiterate." Aga Mustafa said loudly, "They will say I am your son. If I am illiterate, I am your son." Scientific courage and self-confidence were other aspects of Imam Khomeini's teaching method. Late Ayatollah Abbas Ali Zanjani said, among the features of Imam Khomeini's class was his broad-mindedness that he used to enforce at his courses. Therefore, the students would get used to it. He would let different views be raised in the course of teaching so that the students were exposed to various views and reach a desirable conclusion. Late Ayatollah Muhammad Hadi Ma'rifat said, Imam Khomeini created such a change in the seminary of Najaf that attracted us to him. Till then, the remarks of great jurisprudence used to be considered as a sacred domain. For example, if we said this is the view of late Ayatollah Naini, it would be considered as the last argument, since the personality of scholars had such a great impact on views. This had turned jurisprudence from a matter of research into a matter of imitation. Thus, students would not dare raise a view against the view of great figures. But Imam Khomeini caused a change and taught to the students to research on the views of great scholars. Dear friends, Imam Khomeini used to think a lot, although he was a very great researcher. Ayatollah Subhani says that once he had given several books on a specific topic, but the Imam kept only two of them and said that he had to contemplate to find the answer. Another element of Imam Khomeini's success in teaching method was that he would avoid prolixity. He used to express his view in the shortest and most useful possible way. Professor Ghulam Reza Awani says, one of the characteristics of Imam Khomeini's works and books was his succinctness. I mean that there is no room for prolixity in his books. The Imam mentions an issue and discusses it briefly. He usually quotes the words of all his teachers on an issue and then mentions his view. Dear listeners, next time we will dwell upon another aspect of Imam Khomeini's teaching method. God bless.
On Friday, the news agency Reuters published a report on a confidential letter sent by Iran to the International Atomic Energy Agency on Iran. The letter contained information on Iran's safeguard measures in its nuclear enrichment plant in the central city of Natanz. The leak prompted an angry reaction from Iran and other countries. Iran condemned the IAEA and criticized the leak. Iran's permanent envoy to the IAEA, Kazem Gharibabadi, said that the agency is responsible for the incident and that the agency's confidentiality mechanisms are seriously flawed. He said that Iran will shortly take legal action over the leak of information. Gharibabadi stressed that reporting confidential information without following the declassification procedure is illegal.
All safeguards and JCPOA reports, as well as Iran's correspondence with the IAEA and vice versa, are confidential. The IAEA shares its reports in its internal site, only accessible to its member states.
Ali Babadi said that Tehran has already asked the agency to minimize the amount of details it gives its member states in its reports and to avoid providing them with non-essential information. He said the history of Iran's legal protests against the IAEA over its failure to preserve confidential information dates back more than two decades.
In 2018, the Washington Post reported that Israeli intelligence agencies and experts have been have gotten a hold, actually, of sensitive information of Iran's nuclear capability through the IAEA. And this is no accident, given that the IAEA is heavily biased towards Israel. So it's natural that the spies involved have had institutional leverage as well with officials that were working with the IAEA and using it as an opportunity to extract information about Iran's nuclear capabilities.
Indeed, the incident is the latest in a series of tensions between Iran and the IAEA over the matter. This is not the first time that confidential information on Iran is leaked by the Atomic Agency. Over the years, and even before signing the 2015 nuclear deal known as the JCPOA, confidential information related to Iran has been leaked to non-parties to the JCPOA on many occasions. After signing the deal, Iran witnessed leakage of its confidential reports and information by the UN nuclear watchdog numerous times. With the ongoing tension between Iran and the UN nuclear agency, it may be safe to say that the trust between Iran and the IAEA is at its lowest level. Observers say that the IAEA-Iran cooperation problems and lack of trust between them comes from a series of issues. The main reason can be that the UN nuclear watchdog's unprofessional behavior in conducting inspections in Iran. Tehran says on numerous occasions the agency's request was based on unfounded documents or baseless allegations. There were also incidents that fueled the distrust. One of the most significant cases was an IAEA inspector who tried to contaminate the Iranian nuclear facilities with nuclear materials of an unknown origin. Another case was the explosion that occurred at the Natanz nuclear facility. Iran says the only official party that has the details of the activities at Natanz was the IAEA. Observers say incidents like these are the source of distrust between Iran and the agency. No wonder Iran hesitates to allow certain inspections on its nuclear facilities. There are also serious allegations that indicate IAEA's mismanagement to protect Tehran's confidential information, which has led to the assassination of Iranian nuclear scientists over the years. U.S. political influence on the IAEA is another reason. The U.S. unilaterally withdrew from the deal in 2018 and imposed the toughest ever sanctions under its so-called maximum pressure campaign against Iran. Experts say now the U.S. is trying to turn the nuclear agency into part of their pressure campaign. They say the U.S. has always exploited international institutions to implement their policies against certain countries when they fail to directly pressure those countries.
There's no doubt about it. The IAEA is serving as a direct intelligence arm between Israel, the European Union, and the United States as an agency that has consistently demonstrated its bias and preferential treatment in favor of Israel, who have consistently used the agency to lobby for harsher aggression and action against Iran, in favor, obviously, of Israel, who at the same time is not a signatory on the Nuclear Proliferation Treaty, and has weapons stockpiles, nuclear stockpiles of its own that it does not allow any inspection of by international agencies.
Iran has always expressed readiness to further cooperate with the IAEA in a bid to reach an understanding on the unresolved issues. It also announced that it had full cooperation with the UN nuclear agency. However, the recent incident shows that the IAEA once again has failed to build trust with Iran, which raises the question as to why Tehran should continue trusting the agency with its confidential information.
It seems that there's finally a light at the end of the tunnel when it comes to the development and administration of a vaccine against the COVID-19 virus, with multiple research centres finally in the latter stages of producing a viable and effective vaccine against the virus. However, while so close to the end, is the